Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 113. My name is John. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me. I honestly couldn't tell you when it happened. 10 years ago, 15? I do remember it was at a Walmart. Back then, I tried to get my hands on some of the Star Trek novels they published, so I would be in the ever-shrinking sci-fi fantasy section of the Book Cove. Don't knock the Star Trek novels. I think the books brilliantly extended the story of Deep Space Nine, brought about an amazing conclusion to the Borg, even if it wasn't in canon. And the New Frontier series by Peter David is one of the best Trek stories out there. But I digress. Scanning through the section, something caught my attention. In fact, I'm holding that very book in my hand right now. It has a white cover with bold red letters reading at the top, Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. A picture of what appears to be a devil in a business suit with a glass of wine. And the title below, also in bold red letters, Good Omens, with the subtitle in black beneath it, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch. I've always been more sci-fi than fantasy. Give me space aliens, superheroes, and outlandish super science over dragons and wizards and demons any day. Well, almost any day. In my high school years, a friend turned me on to Piers Anthony's Incarnations of Immortality series, and I loved it. The point being is, it has to be something to really pique my interest, which this book fortunately had right on the cover. This may be blasphemous to his fans, but I had never heard of Terry Pratchett before this. However, I knew the name Neil Gaiman very well from his work with DC Comics. So there was my bait, enough to get me to pick it up and see what it was about. I flipped the book over and read the synopsis on the back cover. According to the nice and accurate prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch, the world's only completely accurate book of prophecies, written in 1655 before she exploded, the world will end on a Saturday. Next Saturday, in fact, just before dinner. So the armies of good and evil are amassing. Atlantis is rising. Frogs are falling. Tempers are flaring. Everything appears to be going according to divine plan. Except a somewhat fussy angel and a fast-living demon, both of whom have lived amongst Earth's mortals since the beginning and have grown rather fond of the lifestyle, are not exactly looking forward to the coming rapture. And someone seems to have misplaced the Antichrist. Now, I don't know about you, but after reading that, I was willing to pay the money to give the book a shot. It sounded quirky and irreverent. I like quirky and irreverent. The book was in the shopping cart. We got the rest of the stuff we came for, got through the checkout line, tossed the bags in the car, and headed home. Soon, I would start this new book I found on the shelf of a Walmart. To borrow a line from it, metaphorically, it had just begun to tick. By the time I got past the prologue to the title page, with a list of characters and a brief description of each, I was hooked. I'm a slow reader. I like to read a passage, close my eyes, and imagine how it would look. If I find something clever or profound, I will stop and ponder it for a while. I usually take several days to finish a book. Now, this was no exception. Even though I was enthralled, I still read at my normal pace because I wanted to savor every little bit. I was blown away. But imagine, if you will, an explosion in slow motion. Still bright and powerful, but seemingly ever expanding and never ending. That was the joy I experienced reading Good Omens. I finished the book in bed one night, just before Gina was ready to go to sleep. Instead of setting the book down and turning out the light, I immediately flipped back to the beginning and started again. I read the book 3 or 4 times the first few months I've had it, and I've read it a total of 8 times so far. Nearly 3 decades after the book was originally published, a 6-episode television series was made and recently released on Amazon Prime. Because Terry Pratchett passed away while a follow-up was still in a very early stage, it's extraordinarily unlikely there will ever be a sequel. Although, according to Neil Gaiman, some of those rough early stage ideas made it into the Prime series. Now that is both sad and beautiful in my eyes. Well, I would love to read more about the characters. I like having things left to the imagination. I mean, the book is really all you need to have a full story, but it's so worth reading again and again. Now, if you're anything like me, you'll pick up new things you miss from previous readings, and that just makes it even better for me. We will likely never get the further adventures of Aziraphale, Crowley, Anathema, Newton, Adam, and the rest. But what we do have is fulfilling. Following this warning, I will begin to talk about my favorite parts of the book, what worked well in the series, and what I think could have been done better. I will ruin punchlines, plot points, and endings for anyone who has not read or seen Good Omens. If you haven't read the book or seen the series, you really shouldn't listen any further. While a quick binge of the series will be just fine to understand the majority of what I talk about, I will also mention things that can only be found in the book. I think you get an idea about how much I love the book, and yes, I am totally biased, but I really think you ought to read it before listening further. So, to paraphrase Aziraphale, keep out of the spoilers, you stupid man! First off, these are my favorite parts of the book. There are some things that didn't make it in or got altered in the translation to the series. Let me know if you agree with these. When the Hellhound comes to Earth and is being drawn to the voice of his master, he hears Adam talking, but the view is obscured. Adam is talking about wanting a dog for his birthday. The name Adam gives the dog will dictate its personality. So Hell is expecting a name like Killer or Bone Crusher or Terror. As Adam talks to his friends describing the dog, parts of the enormous Hellhound transform as Adam gets to each aspect of his ideal small dog, including a malformed ear that obviously wouldn't work in a live-action series or movie. The whole time, the dog is wondering what the fuck is going on as it's turning into this small mongrel. Adam finally announces the name of his ideal dog that will dictate the animal's personality. And the name he bestows is Dog. The Hellhound becomes just that, an everyday mutt. If you read the book, you know how awesome that passage is. Missing from Agnes's death in the series, after she has chastised the mob preparing to burn her at the stake for being a witch, she looks up and shouts, "And that goes for you as well, you daft old fool!" The narrator plays it off like she's using her last breath to strangely curse God, and then the explosives she's hidden go off. Later on in the book, when a befuddled Shadwell has fallen asleep, he dreams about Agnes's death, hovering bodiless above Agnes. And you find out her last words were directed at him. It's a brilliant payoff you didn't realize you needed. And there are other payoffs in the book that were fumbled in the series, but I'll get to that later. Lost in the series with the nuclear reactor, spaceships, Atlantis, and the rest, Adam also causes plant life to rapidly grow across the planet because of the rainforest propaganda Anathema shows him. There's a scene in the book that is completely unnecessary to the story, and it didn't surprise me, it never made it in the series, but it's about a janitor named Jaime, who likes to eat his lunch while sitting under a weak little tree in a poorly lit atrium of an office building where he works. As plants start to grow all over the place, and people inside and outside the building are in a panic, the janitor calmly realizes his little tree needs better access to water and sunlight in order to grow like everything else is doing. So he provides it. And the tree grows so big, so fast, he's caught up happily hanging in the branches. I told you, I like to slowly read and mentally picture what I'm reading. And in my mind, this passage is fantastic. In the series, Aziraphale makes the front entrance airbase guard disappear. In the book, you find out where he went. Now, just like the janitor, there was no way it would make it into the series, but when you find out what happens, let's just say it'll make you homesick. In the series, Aziraphale ends up in Madame Tracy's body. But in the book, prior to that, he has jumped around into the bodies of other holy men across the planet, including an Aborigine on a walkabout, a voodoo priest in the Caribbean, and a televangelist in the United States. Now, I am unfortunately influenced by other things I've seen and read, so I always visualize the televangelist as Arlie Emery's character from Fletch Lives, but it still works. Each vignette of a different idea of spiritual connections is in its own right hilarious. And again, I can understand why they needed to cut these from the series because they are not vital to the story. And probably also because the Aborigine uses an Australian slur for homosexuals. But the song titles from the televangelist country album alone are worth the read. Ah, the Bentley. Okay, now, in the series, Crowley plays a lot of Queen in the car. But the book is different. See, Crowley has all kinds of different music, but anything left in the car for more than 2 weeks morphs into Queen. So, imagine Johann Sebastian Bach's music being sung by Freddie Mercury. Now, I get it. That is way too difficult for the series to try to recreate, especially for something as minor as background music. But I would be overjoyed if somebody did this. The classical radio station in town does a bit in the afternoons where they mash up a somewhat modern artist in the style of a classical artist. Now, what if somebody took it upon themselves to create just a few of these in the Good Omen style? I'd buy that on iTunes. I've read through the publication history of Good Omens, and it made it sound like the original printing did not include footnotes, and those were only added to explain certain things to people in other countries. Now, having never seen an original printing, I have no way of confirming this without help. Regardless, the footnotes contain some of the best jokes. from the misprinted Bibles Aziraphale collects, to the explanation of British monetary units, to the former names of the hair salon Julia Petley has worked. They provide as much laughter as the main text. Now, there are scads of one-liners from the book. My favorite is from a footnote that I'll explain later. But things like the description of Newton Pulsifer, that if he were to go into a phone booth and change, he would come out looking like Clark Kent. Now, forgiving the fact that the current generation has no idea what a phone booth is, hopefully they are at least historically aware enough to get that joke. It's simple, sly, brilliant, and sums up the most important thing to know about the character in one sentence. She only appears in the seance scene, but Julia Petley is convinced she must be anorexic because when she looks in the mirror, she indeed sees a fat person. The only character to use the word fuck is the angel. The serving staff at the fast food restaurant has identical gleaming smiles that never reach their eyes. Seriously, if you haven't read the book and are listening to this part, you should be kicking yourself and purchasing a copy right now. There's a couple more things. I'll get to them shortly. People will tell you the book is always better than the movie, and I have yet to find an exception to that rule, even with Good Omens. Whereas the book is always a 10 for me, the series would probably rate 8, 8.5 out of 10. A few months back, I talked about one of my favorite comic book stories turned into a movie 10 years ago, Watchmen. If you recall, I felt there are certain things I absolutely needed to see translated from the book to the series, most of which I got, but some I did not. Some of the actors were perfect, while others left me wanting. I have similar thoughts about Good Omens. As always, let me get the negative out of the way with what I didn't like about the Prime series. I don't know if I don't like these particular things because they were genuinely not as good as the book, or because I had my expectations set unrealistically high. There are times I wondered if Frances McDormand was cold reading her script. And that's a damn shame because I love her work. It doesn't help that whenever I read the narration in the book, in my mind, it's John Cleese's voice. Honestly, this is a book written by a couple of Brits. The humor is mostly dry, cheeky, and subtle, and the timbre of Cleese's voice just seems right. Again, this may be the way I have it in my mind, but I hear the narrator speaking with passion, like a really cool grandpa reading a bedtime story. Also, in this book with so many religious inspirations, the one character most noticeably absent is God. There's this whole ineffable plan, but the character behind it all is secretive and aloof. His, her, its only appearance in the book is in a footnote from a story as told by Aziraphale. There was no reason for the series to make the narrator God, and I think it takes away from the story. I mean, make McDormand the Metatron, since it's God's spokesman. You still have the same effect. Not all the actors fit their parts well, or at least translated the character from the book well. I always pictured Sister Mary Loquacious as a wide-eyed, scatterbrained ditz, because that shows you how much she changes later on when she owns the old convent property and has become a small business owner. In fact, the Chattering Order of St. Beryl is supposed to be a group of satanic nuns who never shut up. And I didn't get that at all from any of them. I was very excited to hear Michael McKean was cast as Shadwell, even though I always pictured him as a much smaller man. He was good, but not great. The character in the book does a lot of incoherent rambling that ends in shouting some odd curse that I was hoping for more of in the series. Certain scenes, he was spot on, like his confrontation with Aziraphale in the bookstore, or his quips directed at Madame Tracy. But there was a certain contempt for humanity in his character that was lacking. Quite possibly, my favorite line from the book is missing from the series. It's about Shadwell and how he hates all Southerners, and by inference, is standing at the North Pole. Now that just gets me every time. With all the stuff they crammed in, you'd think that they could take 10 seconds to add the line and bring the curmudgeon out a little more in the performance. Gina has no interest in the series, despite how much I've gone on about the book for all these years. She walked through the room while I was watching the first episode, and she asked, "Why are there animals on top of the demons' heads?" I don't have an explanation. I couldn't explain why Beelzebub wore a hat that looked like a fly, instead of just looking like a fly herself. I didn't care for the aesthetics of the demons, but it wasn't important enough to take away from my enjoyment of the characters. I mentioned earlier the transformation of the Hellhound is much more detailed in the book, as Adam describes the type of dog he wants, the Hellhound makes the physical changes. I don't know if they were running out of their special effects budget, but the instantaneous transformation portrayed in the series just didn't have the same panache. Also, when the four horsemen mess with the controls of the Air Force Base to start Armageddon, all but Death change from their human forms. And I was especially hoping to see the sludge-like creature pollution turns into, and the metallic cluster of weapons war becomes. They were supposed to be nightmarish, and they looked like they were on their way, but the filmmakers decided to stop mid-transformation. Adam's earthly father is much more stoic in the book. In the series, he's more emotionally distant and buffoonish. But since he's an even more minor character in the book, it didn't really matter to me, but I wondered, why bother with the change? While John Hamm has some cute moments and a great delivery, Gabriel and his little cadre of asshole angels aren't in the book, and watching them, I really wondered if they were necessary for anything other than to provide shortcuts in the narrative. There are two jokes, for lack of a better word, that are only half told in the series. In one case, we see a setup with no punchline. The other is a punchline with no setup. It's briefly mentioned in the series that War is using an alias as a reporter. What's not mentioned about this from the book is she works for a National Enquirer-like newspaper that often prints outlandish stories. The book then cites a few examples with the notation that one of them is actually true. You find out later on in the book that the true story is Elvis working as a fry cook at a fast food restaurant in Iowa. That's why in the series you briefly and inexplicably see Elvis. The other involves the baby swap. At the end of the scene in the series, God mentions that the baby probably grows up to raise tropical fish. In the book, you find out that the leader of the rival gang, who often plagues Adam and his friends, raises tropical fish. I had hoped that Greasy Johnson and the Johnsonites would have made it in the series, but some things have to be cut. Now, a lot of things got cut. But one thing that got cut from the book to the series that I'm actually grateful for is four of the weakest and worthless characters in the book. I mean, yes, the book is a 10 for me, but if there is one thing that I wish they hadn't included, it's these idiots. In the book, as in the series, the four horsemen meet up at a little roadside diner. Unbeknownst to the other three, Death is already there playing an electronic trivia game. And of course, easily getting all the questions right, no matter how esoteric. The book is much more detailed. As each horseman walks into the diner, the trivia categories update to that character. It finally ends when Death refuses to answer the question of which famous person died on August 16th, 1977, even though Elvis Presley is an option, because, in Death's words, "I never touched him." Now, I relay that part of the book to you not only because it's clever, but because four bikers cluster themselves around the trivia machine while Death is playing. When they realize they're in the presence of the real four horsemen, they decide to tag along for the ride. A very, very lengthy discussion follows amongst the four idiots as to what their new intimidating name should be, since war, famine, pollution, and death are already taken. For me, it's easily the weakest part of the book, and I'm fine that they got cut entirely from the series. The abduction and trial of Crowley and Aziraphale by their respective comrades is not in the book, nor Agnes's hint to them to switch appearances so they could escape their executions. I really didn't feel it was important to the story, but I know why they did it. It's the same reason they ended the series differently than the book. The book ends with Adam eating an apple he's taken from a neighbor's tree, walking off with Dog into a hopeful future. And it's a beautiful ending. The end of Crowley and Aziraphale's part of the story comes a few pages before, with a nightingale singing in Berkeley Square. I prefer the book's ending, but I certainly understand why they chose it. I mean, what can I say about the brilliance of Michael Sheen and David Tennant that hasn't already been said? Their performances were the pinnacle of the series from beginning to end, so it's only right that the series includes extra scenes to take advantage of this perfect casting, and that it concludes with them as well. Much of the cast delivers strong performances, even if they took a backseat to the two leads. The series did a decent job of getting the important information about the them to the viewer, and the kids did a great job, as well as the actors who played the horsemen. And of course, I love the voice cameo by Benedict Cumberbatch. Adria Arjona, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, as Anathema Device, Jack Whitehall as Newton Pulsifer, Miranda Richardson as Madame Tracy, all did fantastic in their roles. They embodied their characters as well as Sheen and Tennant. But I have to single out Josie Lawrence, who not only hit a home run as Agnes Nutter, but I would have loved if they could have found a way to expand her screen time. But none of that would have happened had it not been for Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett deciding to write a book together. Eventually, all the applause goes back to them. But wait! Isn't this a political podcast? Don't you want to talk about the religious petitioners who wanted Good Omens removed from Netflix because it's about an angel and a demon working together? Jesus. You mean, do I want to talk about a bunch of fucking idiots? Not really. It's just another example of the collectivism I've been rambling about for the past decade. These people think they got it all figured out. Spirituality, afterlife, supernatural beings. But it's not enough for them to be happy with their beliefs and just leave it at that. They have to try to force others to conform to their ideology. It's stupid of them to even suggest for a show to be pulled because of content. You don't like it? Don't watch it. It's stupid of them to think their concept of religion is any more real than this work of fiction. And most of all, it's stupid of them to demand Netflix remove a series that's being shown on Amazon Prime. You've basically proven that you don't even know the full story of what you're protesting. You're just attacking like a horde of mindless fucking zombies. Happy now? That political enough for you? Great. Now go read Good Omens again. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.